Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Most Granite Staters would agree, getting out in nature is good for you, and some would even say the natural world has healing properties. But can it really offer a cure for mental illness, drug addiction, or delinquent behavior? That's the claim made by the Wilderness Therapy Field. These are camps aimed at so-called troubled teens, promising parents that the power of the great outdoors will turn their kids around. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes, because this field is not well regulated, kids are harmed, some have even died. Today in The Exchange, we're exploring wilderness therapy, following up on the work of NHPR's Outside In. The team's latest podcast is on wilderness therapy. You can listen on our website, nhpr.org. You can also join us right now with your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us by phone, Maya Salovitz, author of Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. Maya's findings were used in the 2007 federal investigation into abusive youth programs at residential treatment facilities. With us in studio, Mike Gass, director of the Outdoor Behavior Healthcare Research Center at UNH. He's a professor in the kinesiology department and also a licensed family therapist. And Jimmy Gutierrez is with us also, producer for Outside In, a podcast about the natural world and how we use it. Jimmy produced the show's most recent episode, as I mentioned, on wilderness therapy. Welcome, all of you. And Jimmy, I want to start with you. What is wilderness therapy? How do you define it?
Yeah, I think this is a question that's kind of been plaguing the industry for a little bit here, and maybe not the industry as much, because they would, I think, agree on it as a therapeutic guided experience in the wild, incorporating best practices on how to treat teens that are suffering from behavioral or mental health issues. For parents, what I've found is that it's a lot fuzzier to navigate that space. And what is a wilderness therapy camp exactly? What it's not is it's not a summer camp that I think most people are accustomed to. It's not necessarily what we think of with camps like Outward Bound. It takes from those ideas, from those camps, but as a whole, it is much different. And I think that's where kind of the controversial part of it comes in.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about what best practices are for sure. Mike Gass, how would you define it? What are we talking about when we say wilderness therapy, and what aren't we talking about?
Well, for me, outdoor behavioral health care is different than wilderness therapy. And it's the prescriptive use of adventure experiences provided by mental health professionals, often conducted in natural settings, to produce functional change for clients.
So outdoor behavioral health care. So that sounds very, I don't want to say medical, but it sounds very professional. Sounds, you know, right up there with licensed therapists and so forth.
It's a movement to become aligned with the way the federal government sees mental health as a field. It's behavioral health care that we're focused on. And also, I think it helps differentiate between sort of what wilderness therapy was and what it is today.
I definitely want to pick up on that. But okay. Maya, to bring you into it, how do you define it? If I walked up to you and said, hey, Maya, what is wilderness therapy that you've been writing about? What would you say?
Well, this is where we get into a serious problem, because sometimes people advertise that they are doing wilderness therapy, and what they're doing is torturing teenagers in the woods. And the big problem with this industry is that it is completely unregulated, and that someone can promise you a Boy Scout camp and you can get worse than military boot camp, and you can end up with your child being psychologically severely damaged or even killed.
What's the appeal, Maya? What makes this idea just kind of intuitively attractive to parents, especially here in, you know, outdoorsy northern New England? Go ahead, Maya.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of different things. The vast majority of the parents that send their kids to these places are kind of at the end of their rope. Their kid has been defiant. Their kid has been difficult. They're not going to school. They might be using drugs. There's all kinds of stuff going on that's causing a lot of conflict in the home. And then somebody comes to them and says, look, we're going to take your kid to this beautiful wilderness setting, and we will solve the problem. And the parent hears respite. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the appeal is that. It's just like getting the kid out.
Getting the kid out of the house. So respite, when you say respite, you mean for the parents who are...
Yeah, exactly. No, and so, I mean, I think one of the important things to realize about wilderness programs is that a lot of times, maybe half of the time when kids are sent, the parents are going through a difficult divorce. And my feeling is that if you are going through a difficult divorce and you need to send somebody away, why don't the warring partners go away rather than targeting the child? This is another real issue with the whole industry, because it targets the child as being the problem. And the best proven therapies for children, and particularly teenagers, are family therapies, which don't say you, the kid, are the entire problem.
You know, Jimmy, there's something else to it that you folks on Outside In explore all the time, which is this, just this inherent feeling that we have that, you know, getting outside in nature is good for you. It does have healing properties.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something that we try to touch on in the story, is that we know that getting outside into space and being around green spaces is good for us, and it does help us. We have a podcast dedicated to that, so we have to rely on that being fact. But I think New Hampshire is a great place for this and this conversation, because it is so much incorporated into our lifestyles. And even like going back, tracing back the roots of kind of wilderness therapy camps, I mean, a modern birthplace was New Hampshire.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And Mike can speak to this as well, but onto Maya's point, the parents I spoke to, they're completely exhausted, you know, and they've tried everything. And for wilderness therapy, when it comes up to them, it is different. It's off the grid. They have not heard of it. And they are kind of at their wit's end with this.
So they think all the usual stuff hasn't worked. Why not?
Correct. Yeah.
What do you think about this, Mike, this idea that, you know, in our literature, in our philosophy, in our poetry, maybe even in our science, there is some evidence or some mm-hmm. thinking that mm-hmm. just being in a green space is great for the soul and maybe even, you know, curative?
What we've been finding in our research is that there are really five variables that really help towards positive and constructive change in outdoor behavioral health care. One is nature, the wilderness. The second one is the use of adventure experiences to challenge the belief systems of the youth to make them more functional. Third one is just the group therapy process that's done. The fourth one is the use of activity-based experiences. So you walk the talk versus just talk the talk.
Can you give me some examples of what you're talking about when you say sort of the power of an adventure experience? What does that mean?
Sure. It engages the child in challenging activities. And from experiencing challenge in those activities, they transfer that into their life.
Can you give me an example? Are we talking about hang gliding? Are we talking let's
say that...
how challenging do we want to get here?
Well, there's a difference between actual risk and perceived risk. And a lot of the adventure experiences, the adolescents are placed into situations where they have to say, I don't know if I can do this. And with proper support and therapeutic process, they find out that they can, and they transfer those belief systems into other aspects of their life.
In a good environment, we talked about best practices mm-hmm. earlier, and I wonder what you think, Mike. In a good environment, how much of this is, you know, the adventure and, you know, being outdoors, and how much of it is just old-fashioned, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, regular talk therapy. I don't know what other aspects of sort of professional level therapy needs to be involved.
It utilizes the cognitive behavioral therapy and other therapies as a baseline, and we're just using those baselines to try and advance that through activity and through experiences.
Give me a little bit more there, because from someone from outside the field of mental health, what does that mean, using it as a baseline?
So, for example, if they were rock climbing on a therapeutic experience and they were saying, I can't do this, but with support and with proper coaching, and they end the experience and they say, wow, that did something that I didn't think I could do in the past. Maybe I should challenge those belief systems in other aspects of my life.
So that experience makes something go click. And the hope is that other things in the brain or the spirit start to go click.
Mm-hmm. And this yes. is, but this is.
Go ahead, Maya. Yeah.
Yes. This is where it can get really problematic, because let's say you choose to climb Mount Everest and you are taking risks. You are doing a calculated thing to challenge yourself. Now, suppose I drag you up Mount Everest. That is a very different experience than being voluntarily engaged in a challenging activity. Being forced to engage in an activity that you feel you cannot do can create trauma. And one of the things that the wilderness therapy people do not like to talk about is the fact that most kids end up in these programs by being kidnapped out of their bedroom at 3 a.m. by big guys with handcuffs, who, I might add, are actually not regulated either, so some of them are admitted sex offenders. So anyway, what you end up with is coercion, stress, powerlessness, all of these kinds of experiences that are exactly the opposite of what traumatized and mentally ill kids need. Now, if a mentally ill or addicted child wants a wilderness experience, wants to challenge themselves, wants to, you know, go up against the elements and see what they are capable of and all this kind of thing, then yeah, absolutely, that can be incredibly healing. The problem is the use of coercion and force and pushing people past their limits.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, because how often does that happen, Jimmy, that kids are forced to do this? Yeah, because Maya, you said 80% of the time? That sounds like a lot. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Yeah, so I can talk about my experiences and the families I spoke to. And there was, from some of the teens I talked to that had used these transport services, there were some that had said that there was no way that they would have ever gone to a camp. And then there were some that, you know, claimed that they couldn't sleep without a nightlight into their adult years and had PTSD
because of it. Because of being dragged out of your bed.
Because
in the
of being,
of the
yeah, kind of. Kidnapped, essentially, is what they said. Within the story, the stories that we kind of illuminate on, one of them was kind of a voluntary. The son was also kind of like, this is what we have to do. I don't know what else to do. I'm up for this.
Yeah, he was all for it.
He was all for it. On the other end was a teen who was lied to and kind of misrepresented, their family misrepresented what they were doing. And, you know, she had a lot of hostility towards her family, and it was just a very tragic story.
Yeah. Well, beyond being dragged out in the middle of the night, I wonder, which we should talk about a little bit later, I wonder, Mike, how much the teen needs to be invested in this to make it work.
There are various levels of commitment that teens will have. And Jimmy's right in saying is that in the beginning is that if the adolescent is compliant with participating, that works. There are other cases where parents have said, I don't know where my child is. I need help finding my child, by using that as a means to get them to come to an adventure experience is sometimes beneficial. So this is something that the field is wrestling with right now. We have run research on the effectiveness of programming with compliant teens, as well as those that were brought and escorted to adventure experiences, and both have benefited from treatment.
What do you think about the chart? Yeah, Maya, hang on one second, okay, because I do want to ask Mike about what you said, Maya, which is what about the extreme cases where teens have been sort of woken up at 2 in the morning and dragged off? Are those common? Can that possibly be beneficial, Mike?
That does happen, and it does occur. And what I can say is that they've been benefited from the adventure experience, even though they were coerced.
Maya, go ahead.
But nobody has ever studied whether kidnapping people out of their beds at 3 in the morning is traumatic for them. Now, presumably, most people with common sense would assume that this is likely to be traumatic, especially because the parents stand by and just let the kid be taken at their most vulnerable. And oftentimes, the kid is disoriented deliberately. They are not told where they're going a lot of the times. The aim is for maximum fear to produce maximum compliance. And especially for kids, many mentally ill kids have a history of trauma, if not most, at least 50%. So it is really dangerous, I believe, to take people who probably already have a trauma history and expose them to a potentially traumatic experience. And I think that if the industry was going to be responsible, before they would develop such a practice, they would actually test it and see if harm is being done.
I also want to remind our listeners that they can join us. Lots of questions and comments about wilderness therapy. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, today in The Exchange, we're looking at wilderness therapy, what it is, what it isn't, and whether or not it can be a cure for some of the things that it aims to cure: mental health problems, drug abuse, behavior issues. NHPR's podcast Outside In has examined this question in its latest episode, and we're following up on that today. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So all of you, setting aside for the moment anyway the question of how kids arrive at this, and I totally get that there's some controversy around that. Jimmy, is there research, hard evidence that it works, that it's worth the money?
So I think this is something that can be best taken from Dr. Mike Guess, because that is definitely something, his research is what I've really relied upon. But what it does get into is that there are distinguishable effects to some of these programs, and especially the collective, which Dr. Mike Guess has put together. But as a whole, the field, it sounds like, from my understanding, is that they're unsure of how and why it works and what exactly it's working or what is working. And the really helpful and clear analogy that Dr. Mike Guess has given me is the black box. And so it's kind of like unpacking this black box. What is it? What is it about getting these kids in nature with these practices is really helping them?
So we don't know, really, what helps and how often it
right.
helps.
Right, and I think this is a good time for you to pick up. Like, there are idea of things that do work, and they have an idea of what it is, but to put that finger on this is what we need to do to push on to other programs seems unsure.
Wow. So, I don't know, given the cost, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, Mike, do I want to pay for a black box? I'm not really sure about that.
The black box has become gray from a recent research study that Dr. Lee Gillis and Dr. Keith Russell did. And we determined that there are five factors that realistically involve nature, adventure activities, group therapy processes, strengthening the therapeutic alliance, and the activity reflection. Those five factors are really the part of the black box that we're unpacking right now and seeing effectiveness for.
All right, we will unpack that a little bit more after a short break. Oh, Maya, I'm so sorry. I will let you jump in after a short break. I do apologize. And we'll start taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
Roads, where we're going, we don't need Rose.
In the market for a modern car that can really take you places? Then look no further than NHPR's Summer Car Raffle. Your $50 raffle ticket could turn into $25,000 toward a new Toyota, Mazda, Hyundai, Ford, or Honda. So get your tickets now because, great Scott, it's almost over. We'll be picking our lucky winner this Saturday at noon. Get in on the fun when you get your raffle tickets now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're looking at wilderness therapy and whether it can be a cure for mental health problems, drug abuse, behavior issues, and other problems that so-called troubled teens may have. NHPR's podcast Outside In examines this question in its latest episode. We're following up on that work today. In a moment, we'll hear the story of one New Hampshire family and their experience with wilderness therapy. But Maya Salovitz, I'm so sorry to cut you off as we were heading into the break there. Go ahead. I know you wanted to jump in on some of the...
Sure.
Go ahead.
So the literature in this area is really a mess.
The black box and whether it works. That's what we were examining.
No. It's not that. It's lousy research. The research is generally done without control groups. It is published in journals that are not indexed on PubMed, that are not peer-reviewed the way traditional scientific journals are peer-reviewed. We don't know whether this works at all because teenagers naturally tend to change over time because they are growing up. And without control groups, it is very difficult to know if this is doing any good at all. The other problem is that troubled teen is not a diagnosis. So you have kids in there whose big problem may be that their parents are jerks and getting divorced. You may have another kid in there who has like a serious developing psychosis. Now, if you are throwing all of these people into the same study and you are not really understanding what needs to change for that person to get better, your research is not going to show very effectively what works for whom or even if anything works at all.
So, that's the point you make in Jimmy's piece, Maya, that kids have a variety of very specific issues and wilderness therapy offers a sort of generic solution.
Yeah, exactly. And also, there are some good studies, but they are rare, and they are looking at situations where there is much, much more oversight and much better qualifications of the people involved than what actually occurs out in what parents can actually purchase.
Let's go to the story of one New Hampshire family featured in Jimmy's story on Outside In. Tim Duggan is on the line with us. Again, his son's story is on the latest episode of Outside In on Wilderness Therapy. Tim Duggan, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Laura.
So how old was your son? I think Jake was his name, right? When you and your wife felt like, boy, he needs help. He's really changed. What was going on there, Tim?
Well, it started with the transition into middle school. Jake was a normal elementary school kid, bright kid, engaging. And as he got into middle school, he started to fall behind. He was really withdrawn into himself quite a bit. And, it's something that happens over a period of time. And I think as a parent, we struggled with where's the line between kind of normal adolescent angst and actual depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies. And so that's something that occurs over time, but there's certainly things like he's withdrawn into his room. I mean, Jake says in the story he wouldn't come out of his room for days.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you know that there's a real problem. And that's when we started to, escalate our approach to it with therapists and the school guidance folks and things like that.
And sounds like from Jimmy's piece, you guys tried a bunch of different approaches, medical, therapeutic, and so forth. What sort of turned you on to wilderness therapy?
Well, we were, and you're right, we had assembled what we called a team, and that was a number of different therapists that were working with our son. And we also engaged an education consultant because as parents, you still have to, you have to live your life, right? And you're on this track with a kid that, he's going to transition shortly into high school and high school turns into college. And this is what you plan for all your life. And so you're still trying to work that plan, but you've got, this major problem, right, that's not going along with the plan. And so we engaged an education consultant who looked at a number of different options for us, and she was the one who suggested wilderness therapy. And again, we brought that back to the therapist that we were working with so that we could discuss it with them to see if it was a fit for our son.
How did you convince him, Tim, that he needed to do this? Was that hard?
I love Mike's term, compliant. It's not so much a convincing him to do it. It's getting him to give up on not doing it. You know, it's one of those things where when you have a child that's in this state, they're not up for anything. Like, they're not looking forward to anything. They're not, you know, trying to help you solve the problem. If you can get them to stop being an inhibitor to something, that's a success. And so I would say that our son was compliant. He wanted help, but he didn't know what would help. And we honestly, I think as a family, didn't really know what this step was. We knew a little bit about it, but we had been through so many things, and we were in a crisis to the point where you're not thinking entirely straight at the time. So he was willing to try, but I don't think that there was. Our family didn't have the capacity for enthusiasm at that point.
Yeah, he was depressed, right? That was what you guys figured out.
He was diagnosed with depression and anxiety and suicidal tendencies. Wow. And had actually been hospitalized at one point during our experience as well.
How did you find the right place for him, Tim? Because as we've heard, you know, there's a wide variety of quality in this field.
Yeah. And I sent Jimmy a note on this. We feel extraordinarily lucky to have found the place that we found. And it's heartbreaking for us to hear the stories of other parents, because I honestly feel like we could have been those other parents. It really is just good fortune for us to have found the program that we found. There were a couple of things I will say, though, that were important to us. When I talk about this track that your child is on as they go through middle school to high school, we were at a point where he was transitioning to high school. As a parent, you have to do something. Like, they have to be somewhere. They can't just be in your house, right? You're forced into choosing something to do. And we wanted to choose something that would not set him back educationally. And so the program that we found was actually accredited high school work that he could do. So it was 3 days a week in the classroom and 4 days of the week out on expedition in the environment. And so for us, that was a very important factor. The other thing was that we actually went and visited the program, fortunate enough that it was relatively nearby, sat down with the clinical director, sat down with the director of admissions, saw the facility, talked to the people. And at the end of the day, it comes down as a parent, do you trust your child with these people?
Yeah, and, it's a tough decision, isn't it, Tim?
It was a leap of faith for all of us.
You know, you mentioned the clinical director, and from what I understand from Jimmy's story, there were a fair number of mental health professionals on site. This wasn't just, you know, let's go for a tough hike or, you know, climb the climbing wall and say we're cured.
Correct.
So how long did it take before you started to see improvement?
We didn't see Jake for 3 weeks. We had a regular family therapy call once a week with him. So there was not a lot of contact. We could contact his therapist if we had questions or concerns. And we stayed in relatively close contact initially just to make sure that things were going well. But we were completely dependent on those reports and then the weekly call with the therapist and with Jake. I can't say that we necessarily saw improvements in the weekly calls, because it was kind of an unfamiliar environment for us as a family. But at the 3 week point, we were allowed to go and visit him. And that was the first time I saw him smile.
Oh, wow. Mm. What a story, Tim. What do you think, and what does Jake think, made this successful?
I think that wilderness provides the environment for the program. And so it's not just wilderness, and it's not just the program. But wilderness is an environment that gives an opportunity to give kids a purpose. And it puts them in a position where they have to have responsibility. If the program is a good program, it'll create a culture of accountability. And then as the kids start to achieve goals, I think they start to look at themselves differently, and that works in conjunction with the therapy in order to as Mike said, to make those changes in personality.
Last question for you, Tim, please, and thank you again for sharing your story. How would you advise other parents who might be interested but might also be afraid? Because as Jimmy has reported, you know, there are some horror stories.
Yeah. I think it really comes down to you have to go. You have to go and visit the location. You have to go and visit the program. You have to talk to the people who are at the program. You have to build that level of trust. There are stories of, you know, these middle of the night things that are just horrifying to me, honestly, or parents that are so desperate. And Maya, I can totally understand that your position where people are at the end of their rope and they just jump at something. And as much as you're in that environment or that position and you want to jump at something, you have to dig down and do that last bit of due diligence. You have to go and you have to meet the people, and you really have to talk to people and develop that trust.
Well, Tim, I'm glad it worked out for you. Thank you for sharing your story with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Tim Duggan, again, his family's story about Jake is featured on the Outside In episode on wilderness therapy. You can check it out at our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now with your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. All of you, real quick, before we go to our listeners, just what do you pull out of Tim's story? I'll go to you first, Mike.
There's never been a better time for families seeking wilderness therapy, given objective guidance and program selection. In conjunction with the Association for Experiential Education, the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council has created an accreditation process that's quite stringent. It's a 23-step process, and it includes self-assessment and visitation and continuing monitoring of programs. And it really has a strong essence of objectivity and openness in the process. So, for example, in creating the ethics part of the accreditation process, we worked in conjunction with the American Psychological Association and the American Alliance of Marital and Family Therapy. And utilizing those elements brought it kind of center stage to the practice of working with adolescents. And I would just say that those programs that are accredited are ones that really are people should look at.
So the Outdoor Behavioral Health Council, mm-hmm. Mike, is what is it? It's sort of a nonprofit accrediting group. It's not a governmental agency.
It's basically programs that came together and said, we have got to solve this problems
of these bad actors, so to
speak. Right,
exactly. Yeah.
And we have to create a differentiation between good practice and what's bad practice. And that's what they created. And there are 13 programs that are accredited and 7 that are in the accreditation process right now.
What do you make of the accreditation, Maya? Does that help with some of the problems that you have written and researched?
It sort of might, but some of the accredited programs have had allegations of exactly the same kinds of practices that everybody, I believe, in this conversation agrees are inappropriate. The problem here is that without actual regulation, you kind of have the foxes guarding the hen house. And one of the things, someone earlier mentioned educational consultants. They're not regulated either, and a lot of them take kickbacks from particular programs in order to send children. So you end up with a situation where the parent is paying, you know, several thousand dollars to this consultant, supposedly for the consultant to choose the right program for the child, and the consultant is getting paid, you know, X dollars by each particular program, and he just picks the one that pays him the most. And so that is a completely corrupt and problematic process that should be illegal, but is not in many states. And so, you know, accreditation is absolutely a step in the right direction, because the programs that care enough to go through accreditation obviously are trying to do the right thing. The problem is that this is all voluntary and that the staffing can vary a lot. There is high turnover in the field. And so you can get a person going from a staffer who worked at a bad program, going to a good one, bringing in those practices, and the kids in that group really get the bad version of the program. So it's difficult. The other thing that I thought was fascinating about Tim's story is that the program that he describes, where the kids are in the classroom several days a week and then they're going out on short expeditions, that would seem to me to be enormously safer than the ones where they are out in the woods, where, you know, if a government inspector wanted to go and check out what was going on, they couldn't do it unannounced because they would have to find out first where they are, and then they would know, so it would be announced.
Right, because if you're way, way out, people don't know where you are, they can't find you to do a random surprise inspection.
Right, and I mean, like, in this industry, I mean, there is a classic example from Maine where one of these so-called emotional growth boarding schools was incredibly abusive for decades and decades. And Maine was doing inspections once a year. Every year they cleaned up for that inspection. When New York came in and did an unannounced inspection, they confirmed all the abuses that had been previously reported.
Can we talk real quickly? Yeah, but just want to bring the other guests in as well. Jimmy, I was curious about the use of consultants that Tim mentions and that Maya talks about. You know, it does seem like that could be an area that was, well, ripe for abuse.
Right. And I think it's just another layer.
Who are these people?
Right.
You know, should
exactly.
we trust them?
Exactly. And I think it kind of gets into, you know, there's some parallel with the consultants as there are with the escort services, you know, which is it's just a difficult area for parents to navigate. And you have folks on both sides, you know, advocating for or advocating against. And I think this kind of gets to Tim's kind of the heart of what he was getting at is it's just a very difficult time. And while his son was compliant, they didn't have the ability to be enthusiastic or really do diligence research. And he'll say he didn't have the bandwidth in that time to go through that.
Sure, if you're depressed, it's hard to make a decision about anything and be enthusiastic about anything, as Tim described. Go ahead, Mike.
I think a couple of things need to be said about the accreditation program. It is objective, and it's the assurance of that is that on the visitation teams, it's not just outdoor behavioral health care professional. It's other therapists that use the outdoors and adventure therapy, different practices. So there is this sense of objectivity and fairness in evaluation. The other thing is that as far as danger, is that it's statistically much safer to be on an outdoor behavioral health care program than for the adolescent to be at home. And we've proven this over the past 5 years. So for example, when we compare the incident rates on outdoor behavioral health care, it's 140 times safer than playing in a high school football game.
Well, but a lot fewer kids are doing outdoor behavioral therapy. So are those rates really, are you comparing apples to apples there, Mike? You know what I'm saying?
No, like, I don't.
Yeah, okay, so looking at the safety, a lot fewer kids are probably doing outdoor therapy than playing high school football.
But so. Doing the comparison, if you adjust for the sample size and the group size, that you can compare the two together.
I've got an email here from Kevin who says, as a small side note, I'm wondering if New Hampshire children would get less out of this experience than a child from a less rural area. Kevin says, growing up in New Hampshire, I really don't think walking around the woods would do much for me, since I was already outside often. Kevin also doesn't like the idea of kidnapping. We've talked about that. Kevin, thank you. We'll follow up on that point after a short break and start taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, a closer look at what's called wilderness therapy as a cure for mental health problems, drug addiction, behavior issue. The team at NHPR's Outside In Show examines this question in its most recent podcast, and we're picking up on that topic today. Your questions and comments are welcome. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Mike Gass, Jimmy Gutierrez, Maya Salovitz, let's go to the phones. And Jake's in Andover. Hi, Jake. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. I just wanted to weigh in. I actually went through some mental health problems myself about 2 years ago. And I wound up going to an intensive outpatient program, which obviously isn't quite the same as a wilderness therapy program. But I wound up doing that voluntarily by myself after I had a suicidal incident. And I just couldn't imagine how things would have went for me if I had been forced to go instead of volunteering to go. It happened when I was 18, so my parents didn't really have the option, but they weren't insistent, and I just couldn't imagine how I would have reacted if I'd been, you know, heavily persuaded.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, Jake? Jimmy told us earlier that sometimes kids who are forced to go end up saying, gosh, you know, I wasn't capable at that point of making that decision, but thank you so much for making me do this.
And I totally get that, too. At my outpatient program, there was a lot of people who had been forced in via hospitalization. And so they, you know, they didn't have an option to be enrolled in the program, but they were coming out the side better because of it. So I as much as I sort of don't know how it, I think it really just depends on the person, you know, every child is different.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your story, Jake. We really appreciate it. And this brings up something else that you bring up in your piece, Jimmy. Some kids go to these programs because their parents send them, whether they're compliant or not. Others are sent there by adjudication. Now, what does that mean?
Right. Yeah. So sometimes and there are camps that I think Mike would agree that veer off of what are thought of as wilderness therapy camps, maybe take on more of the role of a boot camp, mm-hmm. And where it's like essentially a stand-in for time in a juvenile detention facility. I think this starts to get into the area of where you have these higher-end private wilderness therapy camps where you have, I mean, the ones that I looked into were $500 plus a day.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
And kids are there for weeks.
Weeks or months. Tim Duggan, who we heard from, Jake's approximate treatment cost was maybe around $60,000. So, I mean, we're looking at racial issues and class issues within this subject as well. That should be explored.
So does adjudication, Jimmy, mean that the court says, you know, you need to do this?
It can be an option, yeah, to go to a behavioral modification kind of camp.
Yeah. Have you looked at this, Maya?
Yeah. I mean, and you know, some of the worst abuses are in places where people are coerced. On the other hand, what's interesting is that adjudication involves some form of government oversight. So that if a kid is abused in one of these places, they can actually sue successfully because it was done what is called legally under color of the law. So in the private places, there's actually less oversight. So it can swing either ways. But in a correctional environment, things tend to be more coercive and punitive. And that tends to be problematic. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to think about is when you're depressed, when you are feeling low and, you know, mentally unstable, what you generally want, ideally, is to have the people you love around you and to be in a safe place at home. Now, obviously, there are situations where that cannot occur. But I've heard stories of kids who their parent died and they were sent to a wilderness program because they were acting out after that. And to me, that just makes zero sense. The kids already had a major loss. You take them away from the other people that they love. You know, we have to think sort of holistically here and try to, you know, recognize that people are going to require a range of solutions. And coercion should be used only as the last possible resort.
Well, Jake, thank you for the call. Let's take another one. This is Mary in Brattleboro. Hi, Mary. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Laura. So my son went to wilderness therapy and for 3 months, and then he went for 6 months to a therapeutic boarding school that was similar to what I'll call it and describe, where you're in school part of the time and then doing wilderness part of the time. And I guess my big things, first off, my son is adopted. And in seeing, hearing my son talk and also seeing the kids that were there when we did a couple of family visits and family therapy sessions, you know, there's a pretty high percentage of adopted kids and that are going to these programs. And having been in a group for adoptive parents, the thing that really is heartbreaking is that so many of these kids that have attachment issues really benefit from that therapeutic time in the woods of just building back a sense of self.
So did it work for your son, Mary?
Well, let me tell you, he turned 18, so he left the school. And no, I would say, you know, because he was not really finished. And that educational consultant that we worked with, it's a similar thing. They kids go 3 weeks to intensive wilderness, and then they go for years, sometimes years, to therapeutic boarding schools. There's a bunch of them out west. My biggest issue that I really wanted to make was it's so heartbreaking that only a few people can afford this.
Yeah, you talk about that in your... Sure, and Jimmy, you mentioned that. Excuse me for a second there, Mary. You mentioned this, Jimmy. These programs are very expensive.
Right, yeah. And it just, you know, it just prices out certain families. And I think...
Sounds like most families, given the cost that you've talked about.
Correct, exactly, yeah. And I think Mike can kind of speak to this in the billing codes and the work that the OBHC has been doing to try to make this, within that collection of camps that he has, a more affordable option or just even a reality to some families.
OBHC, again, the Outdoor Behavioral Health Coalition, is that right?
Council.
So does insurance, Mike, cover this type of therapy, given that it's often promoted as, you know, mental health therapy or drug addiction therapy?
We're finding greater levels of success on getting insurance reimbursement for these programs. And one of the landmark things that we did is that last year, it actually went into effect July 1st of this year, the National Uniform Billing Committee assigned a revenue code for outdoor behavioral health care. And so now that can be used to cost and purchase these services for families.
Given how unsure this black box that we've talked about, you know, we don't really know for sure if this works. How hesitant have insurance companies been to cover this?
Well, I think there is evidence there and growing amount of evidence that it does work. And the peer-reviewed journals that accept these articles are growing in stature. And for example, at the center last year, with the help of Dr. Anita Tucker, we published 20 peer-reviewed articles.
20 peer-reviewed articles, and that means for the general public, why is that a good thing, Mike?
It's basically before they're put in publication, they're juried by 3 to 4 professionals, and it's double blind. You don't know who's reviewing whose papers, and they're accepted for publication in a competitive manner.
Does it, if I could just key in on, you know, a couple of factors that make this work and make an insurance company say, okay, it's legit, we're going to cover it, it's going to work. It sounds like you said earlier, Mike, that not only do you need, you know, outdoor adventure and so forth, but, you know, professional clinicians, mm-hmm. mental health professionals, mm-hmm. you know, professional educators, people right. who have worked in this field with kids who have mental health issues or drug addiction for a long time and know right. what they're doing. It's not just, you know, going rock climbing and seeing if that breaks something open for you.
Right. These are what I call cross-trained individuals. They're trained in traditional therapeutic practices as well as adventure experiences. So, for example, we have a training program at the University of New Hampshire where in 2.5 years, students will receive an MSW and then an MS in adventure therapy.
MSW is Master of Social Work.
So right. You have these individuals that come out with training in both, but then the mixture of the two together.
Maya, do you want to jump in if you had a kid and, you know, you were looking at outdoor behavior therapy? Would a place that has all these professionals make you feel a little bit better?
Well, I first of all think that insurance should really only cover stuff that we actually know works. And one of the reasons that there are all these educational consultants and why parents have such a difficult time finding their way through mental health care is that aside from medication, very little is studied in terms of what actually works. So I can open up an addiction rehab tomorrow, Maya's Stand on Your Head Rehab, and I can start selling that, and I can start getting insurance coverage for that. And that is outrageous. And this is why parents with mentally ill and addicted children often get ripped off or worse by an industry that has been very money hungry. So I personally would want to start with a complete psychiatric evaluation from somebody who is not affiliated with any program or any educational consultant or anything like that, because you want to know what is the problem with my specific child, not we're going to put some generic program. The thing is, these things cost so much money that if you were spending that on individualized care for the particular issue that the child has, you would be getting more professionalized care at home generally. Now, obviously, there are circumstances where that cannot occur, but the mental health field in general has moved away from inpatient as much as possible.
Keeping kids in the family and in the home instead of moving them off site. You know, so I hear you on, you know, how expensive it is, and you could pay for a lot of, you know, therapy, treatment, counseling with those many, many, many dollars. A lot of the parents, though, that Jimmy talked to, Maya, have already tried that route. You know, it hasn't worked for them. So I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, a lot of times they have and they haven't. A lot. I mean, again, the problem is that this field is so filled with frauds and unprofessional kinds of treatment. It is very, very, very difficult to find actual evidence-based mental health care. And so while people have tried many things, they may not have actually tried what is the standard of care for that particular condition. And that's a real tragedy. Now, I think that sometimes you will need inpatient settings, and in some cases, being out in the woods could be very, very healing. I just think that because when you're talking about adventure and challenge and all of this stuff, it is so dependent on how the person perceives it that you want it to be voluntary. I just think that this industry will not really be cleaned up until it actually has people who want to go there, not just you're forcing them into it.
Let's take another call. And Jason is joining us from Danville. Hi, Jason. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
No, thank you.
Go ahead, Jason.
I've just caught the end of this. Actually, I'm here with a former student of Mike Gass's program, who was at MSW in counseling and adventure programming. And it's great to have him involved in our program. Yeah, I think Mike does a tremendous job in training his students, and we have an adventure-based counseling program that we run, that we've been running for over 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And
in Danville, both, Jason.
Yes, correct.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's both on an individual base as well as group. So we see kids of all ages really and do a lot of adventure program. What we find is one of the elements that's left out of therapy and education, for that matter, is fun. And what we find is you have to find a way to light a kid up, to make him excited about something. And once he gets engaged in something that he likes, then he has some success doing it. And that success, certainly feeds into his self-confidence, feeds into his self-esteem. Defenses come down, and we find they're so much more ready to be involved in the therapeutic process.
And Jason, so, I apologize, we're nearing the end of the program. I did want to ask you very quickly, though, what sorts of issues do these kids have who come to you?
Well, we find anxiety, by the way, is probably the biggest single issue now. And there's so much of that, and for many reasons. And, you know, certainly we recognize that social media is part of that. And, you know, a bombardment, a continuous social media. And that's another reason I think wilderness therapy is so positive and so effective.
You take all that away.
We have referred people to wilderness programs in different places throughout the country, depending on the child and their needs.
Okay.
And
well, Jason, I'm going to let you go. I do apologize because we are nearing the end of the hour. But he picked up on thank you so much for calling. Jimmy, he said something, though, that Maya says in your story, and I think Mike says, too, that depending on the particular children and his or her needs, I think that's kind of the bottom line, right? You can't make blanket statements about, you know, this is the answer, this is the cure, this is absolutely going to work for your kid or not.
Right. And I think that gets into the term that we haven't gone into, which I think is would take up a whole nother hour, and that's this diagnosis of troubled teen and how it means nothing. If anything, it just kind of clouds how to proceed with any sort of treatment. And there are, like, if you can get kids excited about something that they're doing, Tim Duggan, Jake's son, for example, I mean, he grew up in the wilderness, you know, had 40 acres at his backyard. You know, this is something that was very much a part of him. And it spoke to him, and it kind of helped reach him out of that space.
To the point that our caller, Jason, makes, though, that, like, you know, it's a very general field, this wilderness therapy, and every kid is different. What do you think, Jimmy? Is there going to be more sort of vetting by either the government or groups like the one that Mike is working on?
Well, that's, you know, and kudos to Mike for the work that him and the staff are doing. It doesn't look like the government has any interest in this. There's been absent legislation since back in the GAO a decade ago. And how this Congress moves, I think we can be pretty assured that's how the case will remain as we go forward.
Okay, well, if anybody wants to learn more, they can go to our website, nhpr.org, and check out Jimmy's story on Outside In. Again, our podcast about the natural world and how we use it. Jimmy produced the show's most recent episode on wilderness therapy. Jimmy, thank you for helping us out today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
Maya, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate your time. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Maya Salovitz, author of Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. And Mike Gass, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you
nice
for being here as well.
Laura.
Mike Gass, director of the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Research Center at UNH and a professor in the kinesiology department. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.